On today's episode of The Good Word, Fred Katz joins us to discuss Donovan Mitchell saving somebody's job after his Game 7 performance against Orlando, what comes next for that Orlando Magic franchise, and of course, we're going to do a full preview of Knicks, Pacers, and that second round series that's bringing all the 90s vibes. All that and much more on today's episode.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports. Ball don't lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. We're part of the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Get us wherever you get your podcast. It is Monday. I am in Denver, Colorado for Timberwolves Nuggets. And baby, somebody's in trouble. Now, my guest is not in Denver, Colorado. He is in New York City. My man, Fred Katz from The Athletic, or in the words of Josh Hart, Dante DiVincenzo, and Jalen Brunson, Matthew.
There were so many crazy endings to this.
Fred.
Matthew.
Hi, Fred. How are you?
That was a ridiculous press conference moment right there.
Do you feel made? Do you feel made now? Do you feel made now? Is that what it is?
No, I don't. I look, they've been, for those who don't know, my legal first name is Matthew. And until I really started covering the Knicks, the only people who called me Matthew were my mom and you. And then Isaiah Hartenstein and Mitchell Robinson started to push everybody into calling me Matthew. And it's starting to spread. So like I think they were just doing that. They don't regularly call me Matthew. They were just going for that in the moment because they felt it was appropriate during the scrum after they had just eliminated Philly. But Hartenstein and Mitchell Robinson are like, those are committed Matthewers. They're like you. Hartenstein, it's like if somebody calls me Fred and he's in the vicinity, he could have nothing to do with the social interaction. He'll like bust into the social interaction, interrupt everything, and be like, don't call him Fred. You know his name's not even Fred? Let's go right into it.
Well, that's funny coming from Isaiah Hartenstein because some of us didn't know which part of, which part of America he belonged to. You know what I mean? So he makes sure that everybody knows your real name. I respect the dedication to the bit.
That sounds like a Vinnie Goodwill issue.
It does.
That sounds like the ultimate Vinnie Goodwill issue.
It's the ultimate two Americas, shall we say. You know what I mean? Like, it's just an interesting thing. Go look it up if you don't know what I'm talking about. But before we get to the Knicks, because we have to get to the Knicks, yesterday's game 7, Cavs overcome an 18-point deficit. They beat Orlando 106-94 to move on to the second round. They're going to play the Boston Celtics. Either way, it seems like one of those teams was going to be led to slaughter, right? But before we get there, and especially considering Fred covers the Knicks, Donovan Mitchell, if he had gone another year, the Cleveland Cavaliers had gone this entire experiment, right, with Donovan Mitchell and not having won a playoff series, that would have been a really bad look for everybody. But Donovan looked so invested. Like, for those who would have thought, man, Donovan can't wait to get out there, and maybe he can't, but the fact that he showed up after not playing well early in this series, he showed up in game 6. He really showed up in game 7. All he needed was like a guy. Like, there was Caris LeVert. Darius Garland really showed up in the fourth quarter. Like, how did you see that game 7 playing? Did it go with the way that you expected it to? Because I expected Cleveland to win in 7.
Well, I thought Orlando was going to win going into the series. And I thought Orlando was going to take that game 7. And when they were up 19 or whatever it was, I was sitting there being like, man, Cleveland, no Jared Allen. They're really going to come back from down 19. And they ended up doing it. I mean, I'm not surprised that Donovan Mitchell showed up. He always shows up. The dude has a track record of having some incredible playoff moments. And I know he's never made a super, super deep playoff run. And those Utah teams were kind of famous for not necessarily lasting as long as you wanted them to in the playoffs. But it wasn't necessarily because of Donovan Mitchell.
Right.
He had some incredible playoff runs with Utah during that time. And it's not surprising to see him this. He's notoriously, I can't speak from knowledge of covering him, knowing him. I don't really know him at all. I covered one time when he went to Brooklyn Cyclones game and took batting practice. And I watched him take batting practice. And I was blown away by how good Donovan Mitchell is at baseball. It's crazy. He's like, I knew he was a huge baseball fan because his dad worked for the Mets and he's notoriously right. a huge Mets fan and all of that. I did not know he's like unbelievable that he was like with a wood bat, just like blasting home runs in the Brooklyn Cyclones field. And I was like, damn, this guy's amazing.
He's a great athlete. He's like one of those dudes that's probably good at everything.
He is an incredible athlete. And I was not surprised to see him step up the way that he did. I think honestly, ultimately, what the series came down to was the fact that Orlando doesn't really have the shooting or the playmaking. And they are going to have the roster flexibility to be able to go out and get it. I wasn't necessarily disappointed in Orlando for not having the playmaking or the shooting. We knew that coming in. This team is insanely young. I think it's really well coached. I think there were a few things that Jamal Mosley did, which I'm not going to say were bad coaching or anything like that, but I just think it was kind of first-time playoff coaching, mm-hmm. and I bet you yep. those things change because I think Jamal Mosley is crazy smart and a ridiculously awesome coach. Like, for example, fourth quarter of an elimination game where you're losing, he had an all-bench lineup in for 2 minutes at the start of that quarter, and he deviated from it pretty quick, but I was surprised. Maybe I've been covering Tibbs too long, and I live in a world where Josh Hart just doesn't sub out.
Bench? What bench? What's that? That's Tibbs' word. We got a bench?
Where somebody asked Tibbs, did you consider subbing out Josh Hart in the second half? And Tibbs, knowing it was funny, but genuinely said, Josh Hart is never subbing out. I had a passing thought, but I let it pass.
Tibbs plays the hits, man. He knows what he's doing out there.
He knows exactly what he's doing.
He is totally aware of the of what the media is saying about him. No, and to your point about Jamal Mosley, you're right. I think, A, he was on my Coach of the Year ballot, and I felt pretty good about him being there because I didn't know what to expect from Orlando. Like, every year there's a team that we go into the season saying, oh, this team is going to be better than you think, but that's because we think we're smart. You know what I mean? Like, we think we're going to be, like, the first ones on the train to say, all right, guys, remember, I'm the first one to tell you this. The fact that he's gotten Paolo Banchero, who I think is a really good player, but I feel like given where Orlando is, I feel like you've kind of gotten the most out of that given that roster. Like, I feel like he has some flaws in his game that maybe he's going to grow out of, that maybe a real point guard is going like to help him, you know, as far as like facilitating offense for him. But I feel like, man, short of that second half where Orlando just kept getting blitzed, you know what I mean? They just kept getting blitzed and he couldn't find a way out of it. He kept trying to shoot his way out of it. And I was maybe like 11 or 28 or something like that. You know what I mean? But other than that, I felt like I was really impressed with Mosley. I was really impressed with Paolo Banchero because at least he don't scare. You know what I mean?
No, he doesn't. And the thing with Banchero throughout the series, I think there were definitely turnover issues. He had the 9 turnovers in game 1. And again, that's something that happens if you just get like a competent guy who can start off your offense. I think some of those get shaved off. Franz Wagner was just
not good.
I love watching Franz Wagner play basketball. I think he's really good. He was really good in game 6. He had some really nice moments in this series, but 1 for 15 in a game 7. That is not going to cut it. And you look at the guys who took the 3 most shots for them, and Banchero shoots 10 for 28, mm-hmm. and Suggs shoots 2 for 13. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Suggs was 100% in this series. And Wagner shoots 1 for 15. And you're not going to win a competitive game 7 if your top 3 shooters in terms of volume are putting up those percentages. It's just going to be really, really hard. And I thought Banchero played well, by the way, because he got to the line a ton. But he got to the line 16 times. He got to the line a ton, and he was ferocious on the boards. But look, this team has while I thought they were going to beat Cleveland, the expectation on this team should not be you have to beat Cleveland for it to be a successful season.
Right.
For Cleveland, they had to beat Orlando mm-hmm. for it to be a successful season. You can't tank into a first-round matchup and then lose that first round matchup. They had to beat Orlando for it to be a successful season.
I was going to say, remember that. That's just as a point of housekeeping. They literally said, we want the Orlando Magic in this. Remember the wild, wacky last game of the regular season? That seems like 2 months ago because of everything that's happened since playing and all that other stuff. But Cleveland said, we don't want to play. We don't want to play Indiana. We don't want to play Milwaukee. We want this team. If you do that, you better win. Otherwise, somebody's going to get fired. And I don't think it's just going to be roster changes. It was going to be somebody's going to lose their job.
100%. And they did it. And on the Orlando side, this is a really young team.
Yep.
I think they're self-aware about the fact that they don't have enough creation. I think they're self-aware of the fact that they don't have enough shooting. They have a lot of roster flexibility this summer. They have cap space. Really interested to see how they use that. Everyone's got them jumping in on the next big point guard who happens to become available on, you know, if the Hawks break it down, oh, could they be a Trae Young team or anything like that? I don't know. I could see them going a simpler, less obstructive to their core kind of route. If you trade for Trae Young, you're going to have to give stuff up. You're going to have to give up picks, probably some players. Like, you're going to have to give things up. I wonder if they're just going to kind of, like, for example, I know they were expressing interest in Tyus Jones leading into the deadline. I wonder if they're going to just kind of go that route, get a really competent point guard who is going to make all the right plays, never turn the ball over, defend, and is not necessarily the level of a Trae Young type, but also isn't going to disrupt things. You don't have to give stuff up for. I wonder if they're going to go the route. I mean, I think Emmanuel quickly is going to end up back with Toronto. He's a restricted free agent, and Toronto just traded for him, and they will feel the pressure to match any offer to quickly. However, something that we have seen is we've seen a team that has a restricted free agent accept a sign and trade. If you come to him with the sign and trade and say, hey, we're going to make this really big offer, you don't want to pay the guy this offer, let's see if we can do a sign and trade for it. And I wonder if that's something. I think quickly, stylistically, fits in really well for them in terms of ball creation. He's a great team defender. He cares a lot about that side of the ball. I think culturally, his personality fits there really well.
Yeah.
I don't know if that one's going to happen. I anticipate him re-signing with Toronto, but I see a route like that maybe making a little bit more sense for them. That being said, like, I'm they are in a position. If they want to go out and get a really big name, they could make a really good offer while still keeping their core together. They got their draft picks. They got a lot of cap room. Like, they could make a really enticing offer for a really big name if they wanted to. And they're set up, man. Like, they're in really good shape. They got a lot of really good young players. They're in a good spot.
Well, look, my thing with them is Klay Thompson's going to be a free agent. We're not sure exactly how that's going to play out. I'm not even sure if he's the best fit. I like where you were going with the Tyus Jones route. I would think they would call the Portland Trail Blazers and say, let's talk about Ant Simons. You know what I mean? Like, I like him in terms of shot creation. I know he's not a natural point guard, but I feel like he is a point guard in today's game. Not like a CJ McCollum point guard, where you're small, so you're going to play the position. I think he's functionally able to sort of make the reads, understanding the game, and the fact that he can get you 25. He can spread the floor and open it up for Banchero, and he's not going to cost you what it would cost to get a Trae Young. And he might even be a better fit for a team in that spot, Fred. Like you said, Trae Young is going to cost you a lot in terms of your own capital and in terms of what he brings with him to your locker room. Like, is he going to be okay with us saying, if I'm the Orlando Magic, hey, Paolo Banchero's the franchise. Where are you going to fit in? Are you okay with fitting in into a spot where you're not going to be, you know, the featured guy? Like, we have something great that we're building here. Are you going to be okay with that? So I agree with you on the lower maintenance thing, Fred. I'm just very curious what that guy is, who that guy is. But I think they're in prime position to take advantage of a very, shall we say, topsy-turvy Eastern Conference.
Yeah, I think that's true. The other thing that you absolutely have to consider with all of this is, yeah, you want to go get a point guard. But you, if I'm them, your list of point guards absolutely has to be exclusively guys who can play next to Jalen Suggs. Because holy crap.
Yep.
Like, holy crap, Jalen Suggs. The dude is the next Marcus Smart, and he's a better shooter. The reason they are good, the reason they are a good team, and the reason they took Cleveland 7, and the reason they are a team that nobody should have wanted to play, even though they so regularly can't score, is because their entire identity is, we are going to beat the living hell out of you. Yeah, we might lose, but it's going to be a remarkably uncomfortable experience for you in a win. We're going to be crazy physical. We're going to kill you defensively. We're going to rotate well. The intensity is going to be off the chart. And I think their defense, now I think their best defensive player is Jonathan Isaac. But Jonathan Isaac does not play enough minutes in order to impact their defense the most.
Right.
And I think the guy who impacts their defense the most is Jalen Suggs, who, in my opinion, I didn't have a vote this year. If I did have a vote, he would have been on all defense for me. I think he is absolutely one of the 10 best defenders in the NBA. And I think you could put him first team all defense, and I'd be like, sure, no problem at all. I think there's an argument to be made that he had the best defensive season of any guard in the league this year. The guy fights like crazy on the ball. He's completely and utterly unscreenable. His physicality is insane. He's unbelievable getting the loose balls. He really is his generation's Marcus Smart from a defensive standpoint. And now he's learned how to shoot. I would have had him on my most improved ballot. I think he had an incredible season. He's still super young. I imagine he's going to get better. That guy could not leave my starting lineup. And to me, if you have Trae Young out there, it's like, because of Suggs' defensive abilities, you could put him next to a small point guard and he can figure it out. Because he's become a good spot-up shooter, because he's active, because of how hard he plays, you could put him next to a point guard and he can figure it out. But I wouldn't want someone who Suggs has to make up for, like Trae Young. I would kind of prefer someone who Suggs could complement. And you could say, yeah, it's two point guards on this team, but it's two guys who are somewhat interchangeable.
Right.
So like you say, you know, I think Simons would kind of be in that first category, not necessarily the two guys who are interchangeable category, even though I love Anthony Simons. He's a great talent, and the dude is an insane shooter. But I wonder if, like, you mentioned Portland. Just like, you can make a modest offer for Malcolm Brogdon, probably gets.
I was thinking
done.
Of him too. Yeah.
You know, like, just a guy of that ilk, I think could help them, change them a lot, change their fabric, and it wouldn't be very intrusive to their future at all. It doesn't have to be someone who fits their timeline if it's not something you give up a lot to get. And they could also just sign someone. They have a lot of cap space. They could just sign somebody to a mid-level deal.
Yep.
They could sign somebody to more than the mid-level deal because they're doing it with cap space, and they could just outbid the mid-level people, and you're good to go. So I think they're going to do something to bring in more shooting. I think they're going to do something to bring in more playmaking. And I think there's a pretty decent chance they're going to be better next year because Banchero is an incredible talent. And Franz Wagner was 1-for-15, but he's a great talent and is going to be really good. And his jump shot just went into the toilet this year for some reason. And I think one thing that will help bring that up is bringing in more playmaking for them.
Yep.
I loved watching them play this year, and I love the job Jamal Mosley did this year. You know how hard it is to get a team that young to all be like, you know what? We're all going to sacrifice and we're all going to play defense. It's not just about how, like, young players are usually worse at defense, how offense usually comes before offense. It's also like, Vinny, you know this. You've covered the league for a long time. You're old as shit. You've covered the league for a really long time. You know this.
Thanks, Fred.
Yeah, you know this, man. Like, getting a whole team to defend when basically the whole team hasn't gotten paid yet.
Right.
That's the hard part. Because usually it's not like, no, I'm too good to defend. Usually it's, nope, you make your money on your second contract. And I haven't gotten my second contract yet, so I really don't want to sacrifice and cost myself generational money. Mm-hmm. And technically that's selfish because you're thinking of yourself, but it's an extremely relatable type of selfish that I think the vast majority of people would do. And the fact that you've got, like, Cole Anthony the year before he becomes extension eligible and he ends up signing like a fine enough extension. But the year before he becomes extension eligible last year, you got Cole Anthony under Jamal Mosley being like, you know what? Screw it. I'm in. Yeah, I was like a kind of a pretty boy scorer, but now I'm just throwing myself all over the court. I'm going to be a relentless rebounder. I'm going to be physical as hell on defense. I'm going to smash people in the mouth. Like, you got a whole roster of guys who are doing that, and it's before they've gotten paid. Talk about buy-in, man. Talk about a coach just getting buy-in and coaching up a team. I think it's extremely impressive.
No, the point that you made about guys not getting paid yet and still guys still playing hard, for one, that creates an internal accountability within the locker room where guys are going to hold each other, where you don't have to worry about the coach yelling at you. Like, the young guys get on each other because everybody's making that sacrifice. Everybody's defending. Like, even Paolo Banchero, who I wouldn't say is the best defender, but he uses his body. You know what I mean? Like, he's got to get to the glass a little bit more and stuff like that. But he's engaged. And you don't find teams that are engaged for 82 games or for the better part of 82 games that young without some level of ass kicking going on in a locker room. And Jamal Mosley, like, look, they've gone 12 plus wins every season that he's been their head coach. Like, he should be, you know, one of those guys that we're looking at and saying, hey, man, there's only like 7 good coaches in the league, and he's probably one of them. Like, that's where they are right now. But with Fred, of course, we're going to talk Pacers and Knicks when we come back from the break, because that's what everybody wants to talk about, Madison Square Garden and those pesky New York Knicks. You're listening to The Good Word right here on Yahoo Sports. Welcome back to The Good Word. We're here with Matthew. Now, you are now Matthew because we're talking about your New York Knicks. Knicks eliminate the Philadelphia 76ers in six. The Pacers beat the Bucks in six in Indy. No Giannis. Dame was severely compromised with the Achilles. Bobby Portis compromised himself in game four by getting ejected. So, but either way, the Pacers are here. And of course, all the 90s vibes. Spike Lee, Patrick Ewing, Charles Oakley, Reggie Miller, like the whole thing, I feel like it's going to be a family reunion of Knicks Pacers. Never aesthetically pleasing basketball, but compelling basketball. I expect it will be at least compelling this year, not to this year. The Pacers, I think they won 2 out of 3 from the Knicks. The Knicks are probably favored because, you know, they're favored. But is this just one of those style makes fights things? Because the Knicks want to beat you down, slow the pace. The Pacers want to get out, get up the floor. They're not going to, you know, commit all the guys to the boards. Like, how do you see this sort of series playing out from a stylistic standpoint?
It is absolutely contrast in styles. I will say, you know, those 90s series were just ugly, but it was like the good ugly basketball, you know?
Yep.
Like Knicks Bulls in the 90s, that was good ugly basketball.
Yes.
Knicks Heat was the best ugly basketball. And Knicks Pacers
fights. Well, right. I don't know. Is it a fight if punches don't connect?
It's a fight when Jeff Van Gundy is getting dragged around by Alonzo Mourning. That's a fight. One guy just holding on for dear life to an ankle and getting dragged around. Like
Alonzo didn't even know Jeff Van Gundy was on his leg, like, until like 5 seconds later. Like, he happened to look down, like, who is this little chihuahua? Oh, that's you, Jeff.
It's really an all-time NBA moment. But those 90 series with the Pacers, I mean, those are the good ugly too.
Yep.
I actually don't think this is gonna be ugly, because while the Knicks work really well offensively out of the half court, and while the Knicks will force you into playing half court offense on the other end, because they're just, when they're rolling, they're so good defensively. And maybe I have Stockholm syndrome because I watch every single Knicks games. I watch them more. I think they're a very fun team to watch. They make insane hustle plays that very few players do. They send you kind of wondering, like, holy crap, how is Josh Hart getting this loose ball when there's 1 minute left and he's played all 47 minutes so far? They You know, Brunson, I think, is a really enjoyable watch because there's just nobody else in the league stylistically who
right.
plays the way that he does. Like, people right. ask me who Jalen Brunson reminds me of, and I'm like, I have no idea. The best comparison I can think of is he kind of reminds me of like a really awesome center from the 90s who just was shrunk down to 6 feet and had to figure out a way to score, but with their center skills, you know, in terms of his footwork and his post-up work and all that kind of stuff.
He's a six-foot post player.
He's a six-foot post player, and he's unbelievably good at it. And then with Indiana, they play so fast. Even after the Haliburton injury, where Haliburton has not been the same guy after he came back from the hamstring injury, mm-hmm. this team is still second in the NBA in points per possession. Like, yep. it's not like, oh, all of a sudden they fell off and they're not in the lead offense. It's not like they're eighth and we're like, they're just a good offensive team. It's like, no, this is statistically, this is one of the best offensive teams in the history of the game. This is an incredible, elite, top-notch, high-scoring, high-voltage team.
Mm-hmm.
I think it could be a fun series. Haliburton will probably win him a game. There'll probably be some game that we call the Miles Turner game because the Knicks are sagging too far off of Turner, and Turner will hit seven threes.
Yep.
Like that game against Milwaukee when he shot 7 of 9 when they're kind of sagging off of him. They're playing drop, and Turner ends up hitting seven threes. And I think there are going to be Brunson games. It seems like it's now New York Knicks tradition that there's always a Josh Hart game.
Yes.
I think it could be a really fun series. I also think that if the Knicks play the way they're supposed to play and the Pacers play the way that they're supposed to play, that the Knicks should be moving on to the Eastern Conference Finals. They're a good team playing good basketball right now. But you never know. You never know. The Pacers are a good, legitimately good team. They were my favorite team to watch all season. They are just freaking fun. They play beautiful offense. They are, I have said this before, it is a niche call. I believe it. They are the best screening team in the Eastern Conference.
That's definitely niche. That is definitely, we are nerding out here with you, Fred Katz, right now.
Yes, we are. They're the best screening team in the Eastern Conference because they don't necessarily just lay you out on screens. They have incredible coordination and communication on their screens. So they are the best at slipping screens in the whole league. There are so many plays where, you know, they love the Haliburton Turner pick and pop. And there are so many plays where Haliburton and Turner will be running a pick and roll and the coverage will come and it will anticipate a pick and pop coming up. And all of a sudden, before the screen even comes, Turner is going to slip the screen, which is basically just starting to roll towards the basket before he even makes contact on the screen. It'll throw the defense off. Two defenders will follow Haliburton. And all of a sudden, Turner's wide open. He ends up getting a layup out of it. There are just a lot of different ways that they end up using screens in order to open guys up, to enhance their player movement, which is really awesome. They're great at basically replicating transition opportunities while in the half court.
Yep.
Insanely well-coached team. I think it's going to be a fun series. I'm looking forward to it.
No, I think the one point you just made, they're really well-coached with Rick Carlisle, who, for those who don't remember, I think this is the first playoff series Rick Carlisle has won since Dallas won the title in 2011. He's gone 13 years without winning the playoff series and routinely still being recognized, you know, from a strategic standpoint, as one of the best coaches in the league. I think about a guy like Josh Hart, and you see him every day. I think he's going to be so key to this series on a number of levels because you're going to put him everywhere. Like, he's going to be a cornerback who travels, right? I wouldn't be surprised if they put him on Siakam. I feel like they're going to put him on Tyrese, or at least they're going to put Tyrese on him, I think. And he likes to leak out. Josh likes to go to the glass. And that's going to be, when I think about stylistic play, the Knicks are just going to try to bludgeon you and beat you up. Like, that series was beautifully ugly with the 76ers. It was just really competitive. You know, like, I think we even have to take a step back and just admire or appreciate how compelling that series was. Like, game six, I was on the edge of my chair. That was like the first day I'd gotten back home from wherever the hell I was. Can't remember. You know how it goes in the playoffs. You forget where you are the night before, that type of thing. But how do you see Josh Hart's role playing in this series? Because I think he's going to be one of those critical X factors, not just because of the shooting, but because of the rebounding and the defense.
Yeah, he is really interesting because if you look at the outlay of what he is as a player, he's the ultimate kind of guy who you think would eventually be neutralized in a playoff series. Because normally when a player has one really, really obvious, really bad flaw, especially when that really, really obvious, really bad flaw is shooting, normally when that happens, that player gets exposed in the playoffs. And Vin, how many minutes in the six games against Philadelphia do you think Josh Hart rested?
In six games, I would say 20.
You're too high. He rested for 15 minutes.
Man, come on. There's got to be some type of workplace violations that Tibbs is violating here by playing that dude that much. That's just inappropriate.
And he doesn't care. He was asked after game six. The dude, by the way, eats a box of Mike and Ike's before every single game, and then eats a box of Mike and Ike's after every game, and has been campaigning to get his face on a Mike and Ike's box for years. And I guess they're putting his face on a Mike and Ike's box now. And when John Schumann from NBA.com asked him about basically never resting during the series and where his energy comes from, he literally just took a box of Mike and Ike's out of his pocket, shook it, and said, "It's the Mike and Ike's, baby," and then tossed a Mike and Ike's to John Schumann and said to try it. So the guy is bringing his energy to the post games too.
Oh my goodness.
I am very curious to see how the Pacers guard Josh Hart, because the Sixers came out against Hart and they were like, "We're not guarding him at all." And what's going to happen is at the start of the series is Kyle Lowry is going to guard Josh Hart. And Lowry is basically just going to wait in the lane. So when Jalen Brunson gets into the lane, there will always be one defender there, Josh Hart's man, to meet him on top of Joel Embiid, because Embiid is going to be guarding Hartenstein or guarding Mitchell Robinson, and he's going to be there too. And there's just going to be this wall with two really good defenders between the basket and Jalen Brunson every time he comes there. And then what happened? Josh Hart hits four threes in game one. He hits four threes in game two.
Yep.
And then the Sixers say, "Okay, we have to guard Hart a little bit because he can't be hitting those threes."
Right.
And I wonder what the Pacers are going to do. I could see them putting Halliburton on Hart. I wonder what's going to happen there. I wonder how much they're going to use, because the difference is Kyle Lowry is this veteran, unbelievably smart, insanely gritty, always makes the right play defensive player.
Right.
And even though his game has totally fallen off from when he was an all-star, and I think that dude has a great Hall of Fame case, he was so good. Even though he's fallen off, he can still defend. He still knows what to do defensively. Halliburton's not that. If I am the Knicks, and that's the situation that I have myself in with Halliburton guarding Josh Hart, I am running nonstop Jalen Brunson, Josh Hart, pick and rolls, and saying, "Okay, Tyrese Halliburton, do this." Now, Indiana's probably going to switch that. And then if I'm Brunson, I say, "Fantastic. Switch away. Jalen Brunson attack."
I'm blitzing. If I'm Indiana, I'm blitzing, because I don't want to put Tyrese Halliburton on that island and wear him down, get him in foul trouble. He hasn't, like you said, he hasn't looked like himself since the hamstring. It's still kind of slowing him down. I'm going to do everything I can to make Jalen Brunson be a secondary playmaker, forcing the ball somewhere else and taking a chance, even if it's 4-3 on the backside. I am not letting my number one guy, my perimeter ball handler, who handles the ball more than anybody else in the league, I'm not putting him in that position to be punished by Jalen Brunson. I refuse.
That's totally fair. If they do that, here's the thing with Brunson. Brunson is so much better now at handling a blitz than he has ever been. I would say that there is an argument that his biggest improvement, whether we're talking big improvement, whether we're talking like the obvious improvements, like his three-point shooting, or the more niche improvements, I think there is an argument to be made that his biggest improvement and his most important improvement is how he handles traps. So what used to happen is when Brunson got trapped, even last year when Brunson got trapped, Brunson was never very good at passing to the roll man. It was kind of a flaw in his game as a pick and roll point guard where he never really passed to the roll man. He doesn't really throw lobs to, you know, he'd run pick and rolls with Mitchell Robinson. Right. He wasn't really passing to the roll man that much. And if he just comes downhill and you got a guy rolling next to him, he wasn't really jumping it off to him. That pocket pass didn't really come very often. It often ended in a shot. And when he got trapped, because of his size and because when you're getting trapped, it's usually two longer defenders coming at you. And often his primary defender is someone who's not necessarily a point guard. It could be a wing. Like Philadelphia, it's Kelly Oubre a lot. It's Nikola Batum a lot. It's these longer players who teams will use to bother him. And Indiana could be like Aaron Nesmith guarding him, who's got this 6'10 wingspan and fights really hard defensively. I think is a super underrated player. And what happens is if you trap him, what they used to do is they would send up an outlet on the other side. And it could be Julius Randle. It could be RJ Barrett. But they would run a pick and roll with, say, Mitchell Robinson. And on the other side, they'd send up an outlet. And then Brunson would bounce it cross court
right
to Randle or Barrett on the other side, and that guy would attack. But first of all, Randle and Barrett have a habit of kind of hesitating a little bit. And second of all, if they were going to find the roll man, that's now taking two passes basically to make one.
Right.
And Mitchell Robinson is also not really going to create off of that opportunity. Once he gets the ball, it's got to basically be to just go up and dunk it. The way his offensive value is really just throwing down a lob or getting offensive rebounds and then making plays after he gets offensive rebounds. Now, with Isaiah Hartenstein as your starter, or in this case, if you're running a pick and roll with Josh Hart, Brunson is so much better at hitting the roll man. And something that I've talked about it with Dante DiVincenzo, something that DiVincenzo kind of opened my eyes to, which I thought was really interesting, is the reason why he's so much better is because it's not just that, like, okay, he's reading the play quicker. It's that he's reading the play either quicker or later. He's not getting himself caught in those in-between moments. So he's doing one of two things. Either the defender starts to come over and he immediately recognizes it and he's like, boom, bouncing it to Hartenstein or bouncing it to Hart. Or he will say, okay, this defender's coming, and he will start to back up before the defender even gets there, which buys him extra time. And then he's able to throw something over the top or make that bounce pass, and he's able to do stuff. The fact that Isaiah Hartenstein is starting now as well makes a huge difference, because Hartenstein is really one of the best centers in the league at making plays out of the short roll when you have that mini 4-on-3. Josh Hart is really good at it too. So one thing I'd be really curious about is if they're going to blitz him on those scenarios, and if you're running those pick and rolls with Josh Hart because Halliburton is his guy and they come up and blitz, one thing they did against Philadelphia is they started running progressively higher and higher pick and rolls throughout that series. And it was to make Joel Embiid have to come up a little bit higher from the basket.
Yep.
And they weren't doing it all the time, but it's something they did a lot in the early season. And I'm wondering if you just want to do that. If Indiana is going to blitz that play, you do that, you make them blitz at 30 feet. And Hartenstein, you kind of want to be a little bit closer to the three-point arc because he's more comfortable creating out of the short roll when he can get to, like, the free throw line.
Yeah.
But with Hart, I mean, Josh Hart is your ultimate, like, you create a transition runway for Josh Hart, and that dude is in his comfort zone. And now all of a sudden, if you've got Hart going, Hart can create. He can kick to an open three-point shooter in the corner. He can do that little Euro step where he finishes with the right hand and he steps through there and finishes baskets or gets and ones. Like, that's an opportunity for Josh Hart to play make, and he's really in his element in those moments. He can, you know, basically be the Draymond Green. I think the Knicks could find success if that's how Indiana's gonna play it.
Well, look, it's a pick your poison thing. You know what I mean? Like, if everything Indiana does is, okay, let's make sure we get back to pace, let's make sure that we get back to our offense, then there's going to be some things that you give up that you, like, unintended consequences, so to speak, but they're, like, intended consequences. Like, you know what you're giving up, and you're saying, you know what, let's just get the ball out of net, let's go, and let's see if we can beat them in a track meet. I don't think they're going to win the series, but that might be their best play, right? Now, you said you think the Knicks win the series. This is a 2-6 matchup. How many games?
I've been saying Knicks in six. I've been saying Knicks in six. I feel like
right.
I feel like that feels right. Five is too few. I don't think it gives enough respect to Indiana.
Right.
Like that's a good team. That is a good basketball team. Look, if Tyrese Halliburton is playing at the level that he was before his hamstring injury, this is a different conversation.
Yep.
It's a different conversation. He was extraordinary before the hamstring injury. And one of the huge elements that's totally changed since he's come back is the shooting. He was hitting like 40% of his pull-up threes. He was pulling up from everywhere. And it made him really the most dangerous point guard in the Eastern Conference.
Yep.
It really
did. And now he's shooting 30% on 9 threes a game against Milwaukee, a team that was not defensively inclined, let's be perfectly honest there. You know what I mean? Like, there was a lot going on there. But it's such a weird thing. I tend to agree with you. I think Knicks in six. I think the Pacers get 2 games. I think Halliburton gets you a game. I think the Pacers just blitz you away from three, another game. And the series sort of, you know, goes the way it goes according to whatever script it is, right? Before we go with Fred, just a few things. Just I'm very curious about Fred's outside the box thinking. Fred, if you were hiring the next Los Angeles Lakers coach, who would you hire?
Oh.
Right?
Whoever LeBron James wants.
Well, all those guys aren't available, right? Ty Lue is not going to be available. Jason Kidd just got extended this morning. Like, I don't know who's left out there. And this is going to be LeBron's 11th coach in 21 years or whatever the hell it is.
I know a podcast partner of his who's ready to roll.
That, you know what? If that happens, who would be to blame? You know what I mean?
I don't know. Maybe J.J. Redick would be really good. J.J. Redick is an incredible analyst. Every single time I listen to him talk about basketball, I'm like, that dude's amazing. I learned so much from him. And he's so good at explaining complicated concepts in the game. He was a really good player, so he can relate to players. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if J.J. Redick became a really good NBA head coach. He's really good. But I have no idea. I genuinely have no idea. You know who they should hire? They should hire Frank Vogel. That's who they should hire, because none of this was his fault anyway. Mm. And if Frank Vogel ends himself without a job, maybe they should just hire the one guy who got him a ring after LeBron. Maybe that's the move.
I don't know who takes the job, though. Like, you know, it's a dead-end job to me.
Oh, that one I don't agree with. There are only 30 of them. If someone will take the Charlotte Hornets job, and I promise you, someone's going to take the Charlotte Hornets job. Might not be Kenny Atkinson, but someone's going to take the Charlotte Hornets job. Then they'll take the Los Angeles Lakers job. I promise you that. I mean, there are the names that we hear conventionally. I know a lot of people who love Charles Lee. I've always heard great things about him as somebody who could really be good. You know, I mentioned Kenny Atkinson because he had turned down the Charlotte job a few years ago before Steve Clifford got it. I've always thought Kenny Atkinson deserves another shot, and I think he's had opportunities for other shots, and he's decided to stay with Golden State.
Right.
But I've always thought Kenny Atkinson deserves another shot. Mike Budenholzer did not lose either of his jobs because he didn't know how to coach basketball. I'll tell you that much. Like, Mike Budenholzer lost his job in Atlanta because he just kind of wore it out by being Mike Budenholzer. And I think a similar sort of thing happened in Milwaukee. But hey, look at what has happened to Milwaukee without Mike Budenholzer. Look what they were before Mike Budenholzer. He is the ultimate. We are going to trim the fat coach. We're going to be good at all the things that we're supposed to be good at. Honestly, he kind of, in a way, has always reminded me of the guy that I cover, Tom Thibodeau, who I think has done a magnificent job this year, where it's just like all the basic stuff.
Yep. Yep.
All the basic stuff that you need to be good at in order to win. Like with Tibbs, it's like, if you have Tibbs, you're going to be good on the boards. You're going to defend every night.
Yep.
You're going to play really hard. You're going to practice really hard. You're going to be extremely prepared. Like, those are the basic things where it's like, those things will show up every single night. And then maybe you'll make shots and maybe you won't. But those things are going to show up every single night. You are going to know every other player's tendency. You're going to go out there and play really hard. You're going to practice really hard. You're not going to lose the rebounding battle. You are right. going to play well defensively, like all those sorts of things. Like Bud is very similar in that sort of sense. Maybe that's something that the Lakers could use. Maybe they should just re-sign Kyle Kuzma and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope and Alex Caruso.
Mm.
Maybe that would be helpful. I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do. To be honest, I haven't really like checked in with sources on who it could be. But do you think they're going to go with another first-time head coach, or do you think they're going to hire somebody more veteran?
I think you have to hire someone more veteran. Because to me, Darvin Ham made mistakes that first-time head coaches make, right? Where rotation issues, you know, when do you call timeouts, things like that, right? Those are things that you learn through experience. Those are things that you only get through trial and error. And coaching LeBron James doesn't leave you a lot of space for error. It doesn't leave you a lot of space to let me see if I can figure this thing out, especially as he gets older, especially as he's probably only guaranteed to play between 55 and 60 games in a season. And you have to start considering, maybe not LeBron first, but you have to start considering Anthony Davis first, because he's the guy that's actually going to be around beyond the next 2 years. And you have to figure out how to maximize him. I don't think that's a job for a first-time head coach. And like, I don't think, like John just popped in. John says Terry Stotts. I don't think the Lakers would consider Terry Stotts to have enough panache, so to speak. That wouldn't be snazzy enough for the Lakers to hire a guy like that. Budenholzer, yeah, I could see that. I think they were probably banking on, let's see what happens with Ty Lue. Let's see what happens with Jason Kidd. And those franchises are like, no, we're not losing our guy to you. And now they're in a tough, now they're in a very tough spot. And like you said, margin for error to me is less about the coach and more about the roster. Margin for error is on, you can't take Jalen Hood-Safino and you've got Podziemski and Jaime Jaquez Jr. right behind it. You know what I mean? Like, those are the mistakes that a franchise can't afford to make. And then putting a rookie head coach in there and expecting him to figure it all out, or saying, you know what, y'all, just because we won this in-season tournament and we went, you know, we had a bad stretch after that, that's going to be the stretch that gets you fired. That means he was never really going to succeed in the first place. By and large, I believe you can make the case to fire 20 of 30 NBA head coaches if you wanted to. You could literally just go out and say, I don't like how Nick Nurse handled that series. I feel like he blew a couple games. Fired. You could literally say these things about 80% of the coaches in the league, and you can justify it and make the case. Doesn't mean you should, but it means you could. And that's where the Lakers are, I think, with Ham and some of these other guys that they're going to be interviewing.
Yeah, I wonder if they need a veteran coach, to be honest. Every once in a while, somebody who's not a veteran coach pops up, and you're like, damn, he's really good. Like,
so,
I think
so you're going to, with the J.J. Redick? Is that your vote?
No, I don't have a vote. I'm a huge believer that until you actually see a guy be a head coach, we have absolutely no idea on the outside if someone is good or not. Mm-hmm. Every single time someone gets hired and is a longtime assistant or whatever, and they get hired, every single time, all I hear is how great that coach is. Every time. And to be clear, I'm not accusing people of blowing smoke up my ass. Like, I don't think that is what's happening. I think what's happening is, in order to get hired to be a full-time head coach, you need to be a really good assistant head coach.
Right.
And so if you're a really good assistant or a really good assistant coach, everyone's going to be like, that guy's amazing. But not everything is translatable. Some people, you know, what is it? The Peter principle? You get promoted eventually into the position that you're no longer qualified for. Some people just get Peter principled at head coach, and it can be really difficult to figure out who. David Adelman is a name that you hear come up all the time as like a really respected assistant coach who people love. He's with Denver, and people love David Adelman.
Yeah.
Charles Lee is somebody who I mentioned. You know, you could look at the college ranks and see if there's some, you know, if you want to go after like a Hurley and see what you can do there. Like I think there are always options, but you look at some of the really good young, like look at some of the best coaches in the league. And it's like, we just talked about Jamal Mosley. I would take him coaching my team, you know, 7 days out of the week. Dude's really good. Taylor Jenkins, first time head coach. As soon as he stepped in, I'm like, that guy is obviously really good. Mark Daigneault, coach of the year. Yep. Like he's still in his 30s, and that was his first
but
job.
You just called me old as shit, and I'm still in my 30s, Fred.
Yeah, but in terms of your personality, you're kind of in your early 50s. You're like a guy who's in his early 50s who pretended like he was around before that, you know?
And you just gave up. I'm just Googling Peter Principle, and you calling me an old ass man. You know where I found you, Fred? This is where I found Fred. No, I'm not going to say that. That Fred's face is red over there. That's why I love Fred Katz. I wish I was covering Knicks Pacers so I could go hang with my man, Fred Katz. Thank you, Matthew. Really appreciate you today.
I am so thrilled to be on. I get so excited to pop with you. You're the best. Your listeners should know how lucky they are. You're the best.
I hope they, if they do, they should give, you know, like 5-star reviews and donate and all that other type of stuff. Even though you can't like donate, but, you know, throw some money in the collection plate. You know what I mean? That sort of thing. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is Fred Katz, or as his mother calls him, Matthew. We would like to thank him for giving us some of the time today. Don't forget, he's also on the Athletics NBA show. And Knicks fans, of course, you guys should subscribe to Katz and Shoot. So, look, I like that name. That name is kind of catchy, Fred. I like that. Don't forget, Fred also writes for The Athletic, so check him out there. Thanks to producer John and the entire team who works hard behind the scenes on making this podcast as good as it is. Dan will be back tomorrow for another episode of Divine Intervention. I'll be back on Wednesday for another episode of The Good Word. I have no idea where I will be. Maybe I'll be home. Maybe I'll be in Minnesota. Maybe I'll still be here in Denver. I have no clue. But until then, everybody be safe.